Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, jobs, ads, and oil. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 21st of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today by looking back to the number of people who made their initial claims for unemployment benefits for the week ended last Saturday. 201,000 is the number. That's down about 20,000 or so from the week prior, so fewer people losing their jobs and making first-time claims. The number of people who have been filing dropped as well to about 1.7 million. It's the lowest that number's been since the beginning of the year. And it is indeed a sign this labor market is still pretty tight, even after the last year and a half of Fed rate hikes that have been trying to loosen things up. So, on the just how resilient is this labor market anyway beat for us today is our own Elizabeth Trovall.
After weathering some blustery economic headwinds, business owners and employees might just be approaching calmer waters, says Luke Pardue at payroll firm Gusto.
Business owners can expand when they want to. They can selectively backfill roles. Workers who have been laid off have a relatively easy time finding a new job. And all of those are really encouraging cycles that kind of head off any recessionary signals we might be seeing.
Also optimistic about avoiding the R word is Layla O'Kane, an economist at Lightcast. She says while the labor market may have been cooling, it ain't cool. That means employers with many job openings are holding on to talent.
And instead of saying, hey, workers, we're going to lay you off, they're just taking down those openings and sort of accepting the fact that they're probably not going to be able to get people in those jobs and making do with what they have.
And it's more than just making do, says Kathleen Quinn Votaw with recruitment firm Talent Trust. She says keeping in-demand workers happy is also important for the bottom line.
If you don't have somebody to serve your customers or do the work, you're just not going to be able to capture the revenue and the gross margin. Because at the end of the day, robots can't replace everything.
And big hiring sprees, or armies of robot workers for that matter, are not exactly on the horizon for a lot of companies. Julia Pollack is with ZipRecruiter.
Many of our customers tell us that these high rates are reducing the hiring plans because in order to expand headcount, they need to open another location or invest in more equipment.
But even without big expansions, there are still more jobs out there than workers available to fill them. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
The data in that first-time claims report that Elizabeth was just talking about, like a whole lot of other economic data we pay attention to on this program, is collected by and reported to us by the federal government, parts of which are going to stop working in something like 10 days unless Republicans in Congress can have a meeting of the minds. The parts we are concerned with right now include the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau, whence, among other things, the monthly jobs report and the CPI come. Not great not to have them when the Federal Reserve could really use a clear picture of how the economy is doing right now. Marketplace's Savannah Mars on that one.
During the 16-day government shutdown in 2013, former Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica Groshen was one of three people coming into work at the agency. One day, she got a call from the Federal Reserve.
They wondered whether they could fund the BLS to produce various data that they needed for their monetary policy making decisions.
The Labor Department's lawyers said no, that would violate the will of Congress. But the request shows how valuable government data is to the Fed's work.
This data is really infrastructure for our economy.
The good news is that there is a lot of economic data that's collected elsewhere.
That's Andrew Levin, a professor of economics at Dartmouth College. He says the Fed already looks at data gathered by the private sector, trade groups, and nonprofits, and it can lean extra hard on those sources during a shutdown. But according to Keith Hall at the Mercatus Center,
government data, some of it is just too key and reliable to substitute private market data.
And in many cases, data about inflation or labor market conditions can't be recaptured after the fact. Hall says even though economic data collection is considered non-essential during funding impasses,
we're pushing that notion of is it urgent at the moment.
Because without that information, Hall says the Fed isn't exactly flying blind, but it's not going to be comfortable making rate hike decisions. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I'll tell you what, the bond market was listening real close to Jay Powell yesterday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's kind of a fact of American political life that campaign season never really ends or formally begins. It just kind of ebbs and flows. And right now, we are gearing up for a big, big flow. And over the next year or so, you are going to be hearing a lot about how much money campaigns are collecting and, more to the point, spending. It's shorthand, really, a way to gauge where candidates stand in any given race and where they might be going. A lot of that spending, of course, goes to television ads. But how much political TV ad costs, as is true with many other things in our politics, is a little bit convoluted. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looked at one show on one channel in one city to set things straight.
In Lexington, Kentucky, the local CBS affiliate airs Jeopardy at 7:30 p.m. It's primetime TV, coming out of the evening news and Wheel of Fortune. And Jeopardy's audience is a prime target for the two candidates running for governor in the state's November election.
I made it to college football as a walk-on. None of the scholarship, but all the hard work.
Anyone who was watching earlier this week saw political ads from the candidates, including Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron. They also saw an ad from an outside group, a political action committee supporting his opponent, Democratic incumbent Andy Beshear.
For years, Cameron's refused to appoint a special prosecutor, even as some of the criminals were arrested for new crimes.
But even though those ads were the same length, on the same show, on the same day, the price tags were very different. Michael Franz is co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ad spending. He says for the official campaigns of candidates for office, by federal law,
they're afforded what's called the lowest unit rate, essentially the cheapest option available from the broadcast station.
But that is not the case for any of the other groups that advertise during campaigns. PACs, so-called super PACs, trade associations, interest groups. Marshall Cohen is a partner at KMM Strategies, who works with Democratic campaigns across the country.
As anyone who watches television in a swing state can tell you, there's often lots of different names for these entities, and it's very hard from a viewer perspective to sometimes tell the difference.
All these other groups have to pay the market rate for ads. According to filings with the Federal Communications Commission, for those 30-second Jeopardy ads, the official campaigns for Beshear and Cameron paid $400. But Defending Bluegrass Values, the political action committee backing Beshear, paid $1,200, three times as much, to get in front of Jeopardy's audience. GOP strategist Zach Roday with Ascent Media says as election day gets closer and ad inventories dwindle, that price disparity will only get bigger.
Some estimates in Kentucky see it going maybe as high as 5-1. And so you can really see how the dollar for the candidate goes further and the super PAC needs more money in order to catch up.
These outside groups can raise more money because, unlike campaigns, most of them aren't subject to contribution limits. So magnify what's happening in Kentucky by a few million or perhaps billion dollars, and you have a snapshot of the coming ad wars of the House, Senate, and presidential races in 2024.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
This spending balance between campaigns and outside groups will shape what the rest of us will be stuck watching for the next year. Michael Franz at the Wesleyan Media Project points out the candidates themselves run different kinds of ads than the outside groups.
And we've seen that evidence somewhat consistently across time, that the candidates feel compelled to do a mix of things like attacking a candidate, but also promoting themselves. And the super PACs don't feel that same need.
Federal Election Commission rules prohibit super PACs from coordinating with the campaigns they support, so they often just go to town on the ones they don't. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Without putting too fine a point on it, New York City has about had it with Airbnb. The company calls the city's new law on short-term rentals a de facto ban. The fine print is that if you want to rent out your place for less than 30 days or you want to be out of the house while the guests are there, the city says no, you're not. As yet unclear what it's going to mean for the notoriously tight and notoriously expensive supply of housing in the biggest city in this country. Heather Tell Murphy wrote about it in Slate. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Give us a sense, would you, of exactly how strict this rule in New York is?
Yeah, so, you know, the whole world has grappled in different ways with how to regulate Airbnb. New York City, which has had a lot of Airbnbs for a long time, has been one of the laxest markets. There's been rules, but they haven't really been enforced. They've been kind of confusing. And suddenly, we're actually one of the strictest markets. It's really difficult for hosts to list something for less than 30 days unless they want a guest in the apartment or home where they live.
Mm-hmm. At whom is this aimed? I mean, am I talking about, you know, some guy who owns an apartment in like Brooklyn someplace who is now, you know, challenged if he wants to rent it out? Or is it, you know, sort of larger landlordy kind of places?
Yeah, there have been investors who have been buying up houses and apartments and different things just with the sole purpose of putting them on Airbnb.
Right.
There's also been landlords who saw, oh, I can make three times as much putting something on Airbnb as renting to a longer term tenant. At the same time, as much as, you know, perhaps even if we're talking about 11,000 units, there's different numbers that people give of how many units might go back mm-hmm. to become housing. Even if that happened, the reality a lot of people say is New York City is a huge city that wouldn't even be half of the total units that were made in new construction last year. And so the idea that suddenly taking even 11,000 units and putting them back immediately on the housing market is going to impact and bring down the prices overall immediately, unfortunately, that's probably not true. And even some of the people pushing for this law acknowledge that. However, in small neighborhoods, in some parts of neighborhoods that were really disproportionately impacted, you could imagine that even if the price didn't change that much, suddenly the experience of trying to get a place in that neighborhood and the dynamics in that neighborhood will change significantly.
It has to be said that there are people who Airbnb their places or another place that they own, perhaps in New York. And the reason that they can stay in New York is because they have the income from that extra place. And now they're challenged in that.
Absolutely. I mean, there are people who still are that ideal that Airbnb has tried to push over the years a lot. Like, you know, here's this really sympathetic person who's just getting by on their mortgage because they're Airbnbing those place. And sometimes that's a little bit of a fiction because there's all these huge investors who buy tons of Airbnbs and manage tons of places. And it's not kind of that sweet little story. But those sweet little stories actually are still true. I've talked to some of those people. There are hosts who definitely were paying their mortgage or or just, you know, relying on the income that came from renting either their basement unit, the other side of a duplex. And so those people are also affected because, again, what's kind of wild about this rule is that even if it's your basement unit, you cannot get registered for less than 30 days. Mm-hmm. So you could put it on Airbnb for more than 30 days, but even if it's your own unit, you actually wouldn't be supposed to rent it out while you're on vacation unless you were there.
Right. You know, New York City is not the only city on the planet that's trying to figure out what to do about Airbnb. Is there a model of peaceful coexistence out there, perhaps a happy medium?
It really depends who you ask. There are so many different models. One way that quite a few cities have put limits on it is to say you can rent out your place, but for no more than this many days, like 30 days or 90 days or something like that. But other places, you know, have taken even stricter approach. New York City is going to be pretty lax for anyone who wants to rent it out for more than 30 days. So from that lens, you know, in some ways there is still possibility for people to put it on Airbnb.
Heather Tal Murphy, writing at Slate, most recently about Airbnb in New York City. Heather, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you so much for chatting.
Coming up.
Americans hate the speed limit. They hate it.
You ever heard of the Autobahn? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 370 points, 1%, 34,070 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 245, that is 1.8%, 13,223. The S&P 500 gave back 72 points, about 1.6%. 43,030. Computer network equipment maker Cisco Systems is buying security software company Splunk. The deal is valued at $28 billion. Splunk surged 20%. Costco sank 3.9%. Come on, it's fun to say. FedEx added 4.5%. First quarter earnings topped expectations. UPS lost about 1.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 4.48%. Why, you ask? Because Jay Powell said yesterday, maybe we'll raise some more, but we're going to keep rates high. Not coming down anytime soon. You are listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tomorrow will be 2 weeks of the UAW strike. There's still no agreement on pay and benefits, work week or work hours, which we mentioned the other day, and how much the car makers can rely on temporary workers. The companies say that temps give them flexibility. The union says temps ought to be made permanent after 90 days. Detroit is, of course, in the headlines right now, but as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, the auto industry isn't alone in American manufacturing in relying on temps.
Across the labor force, about one out of every 50 workers is temporary, but on the factory line, it's one in 10. That's according to analysis by Susan Hausman, an economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research.
The use of temps in manufacturing is quite prevalent, and it's been growing over time.
One reason manufacturers turn to temp employees is it lets them scale their workforce up and down as needed.
Take autos. You've got new models coming on every year. And so there's a ramping up of production when a new model comes.
Temporary status also lets companies screen workers before giving them permanent jobs. And sometimes they use it to reduce labor costs. The UAW says under its current contract, temps can earn half as much as permanent employees. There are downsides for employers, too, points out Aaron Hutton, author of the book The Temp Economy.
Temps tend to be less trained for the job, less invested in that particular workplace because, you know, they don't know if they're going to be there tomorrow.
And that ambivalence can be catching. Wharton's Peter Capelli found that when more temps were introduced into a workplace, the job performance of permanent employees fell.
Temp work is often thought of, understandably, as kind of second-class work. And it lowers your own view of the value of your job the more temp workers are working with you.
Capelli says employers have to consider whether temp employees will save them money or cost them money by dragging down productivity. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
As of 2022, the United States was the biggest oil producer on the planet, 20% of daily global production, according to the Department of Energy. It hasn't always been that way, and if you're looking for a moment when both the economics and the politics of the American energy industry changed, 50 years ago this fall is where you want to start. October 1973. In response to American support for Israel in the Yom Kippur War, Arab members of OPEC cut off their oil exports to the United States. And that hit hard, and right away, gas supplies cratered, prices shot up, and drivers lined up for blocks to fill their tanks. As Marketplace's Henry Epp reports, the government's response changed how this country uses and acquires its energy.
Amy Myers Jaffe remembers the gas lines.
There was one gasoline station in the little town that I grew up in. And so lines would form for that gasoline station at 5 a.m. because gasoline would literally run out.
Jaffe is an energy expert at New York University. To Americans in 1973, she says, the idea that there suddenly wasn't enough gas to go around was shocking.
The automobile was king. People were used to not only driving everywhere to the store, to work, and so forth, but there was also this sort of sense that of freedom and mobility.
In early November 1973, then-President Richard Nixon addressed the nation. He said the country would embark on a new course, centered around two concepts which at that point were brand new to most Americans. The first, energy conservation.
In the short run, this course means that we must use less energy. That means less heat, less electricity, less gasoline.
Nixon asked Americans to voluntarily turn down the thermostat, turn off lights, carpool, and use mass transit. His administration also required some changes, says Meg Jacobs, who teaches American history at Princeton.
He's the person who imposes a national speed limit, for example. Americans hate the speed limit. They hate it.
That loathed limit of 55 miles per hour stayed on the books until 1995. But another conservation measure stemming from Nixon's response has had a longer life, fuel efficiency standards for cars. Brian Black, a history and environmental studies professor at Penn State Altoona, says until the energy crisis, Americans didn't think about what kind of gas mileage their cars got. They were focused on other things.
The chrome, the type of stereo, whatever.
Black says efficiency standards gave drivers new choices.
And this is when we get into especially Japanese manufacturers coming into the marketplace and providing consumers with an option in size and efficiency, at least.
Still, the standards applied to each car maker's fleet, which left a loophole that let them market gas-guzzling SUVs. So the legacy of Nixon's call for energy conservation is mixed. But that was just one half of his plan. The other, also brand new to most Americans, energy independence.
In the long run, it means that we must develop new sources of energy, which will give us the capacity to meet our needs without relying on any foreign nation.
Nixon hoped to make the U.S. entirely energy independent by 1980. That didn't happen, but it did lead to more oil production in the U.S. Imports eventually peaked in 2005, and fracking and other technologies have recently made the U.S. the world's leading oil producer. Nixon's push also spurred research and development into wind, solar, and nuclear power, and electric vehicles. For a while, the U.S. was a leader in those areas. A few years after the embargo, President Jimmy Carter even put solar panels on the White House. Again, Brian Black of Penn State.
To Jimmy Carter and many other people, that was just a good idea.
But when oil prices dropped again in the 80s, that commitment to renewables didn't stick.
When Ronald Reagan became president, to him that was a symbol of weakness.
Reagan took down the White House solar panels, and the U.S. eventually ceded its advantage in renewables. Now, with the Inflation Reduction Act, we're trying to play catch-up, says Amy Myers Jaffe at NYU.
If we'd have stayed the course since 1973 to today and not had this volatility of commitment of policy and commitment of science dollars, we'd be in a much better place.
But some of those technologies are finally being used on a broader scale. Electric vehicles, for example. Jaffe drives one now.
When the gasoline price goes up, doesn't affect me.
And those 5 a.m. gas lines can stay a childhood memory. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which will appeal to the history buffs and the numismatists out there. A 1934 $10,000 bill sold at auction last week for $480,000. It was uncirculated, the bill was, it has to be said, and apparently in pristine condition. Now, who is on the $10,000 bill? Do you know? Salmon P. Chase is who. And who was Salmon P. Chase? Abraham Lincoln's Treasury Secretary, of course. All right, we are going. Here is your moment of economic context, though. It comes to us courtesy of the National Association of Realtors, which said this morning that home sales were basically steady July to August. Median home price, though, up about 4%. That is from August a year ago. Here is the kicker. It's from the association's chief economist. This is a quote. Supply needs to essentially double to moderate home price gains. Home supply has to double. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Card, Iantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.